Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, February 3rd, and today we talk politics. Today it's with the Grand Old Party. Hawaii Republicans have seen a revolving door of leadership. We talk to Shirlene Ostroff, who's in the driver's seat for the second time as party chair. We also learn more about a seat in the Senate occupied by a longtime Democrat. Will the veteran lawmaker step down? And we talk about free speech in a one newspaper town. Could censorship that happened in Alaska happen here? Plus, we trace the humble beginnings of a technology that's been saving the lives of surfers and swimmers for decades. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Hawaii Republican Party has had a revolving door with three different party chairs in the last 6 months. Shirlene Ostroff is back in the driver's seat after a stint 5 years ago. She stopped by our studios this morning. She just returned from a National Republican Committee meeting on the mainland.
The Republican National Committee is determined to ensure that our president can be a four-year president. And that is trying to make sure that we defy history and make sure that there's only been three times in 120 years that the House and the Senate haven't flipped after a presidential election. And so in order for the president to continue his agenda, we have to make sure to keep both the House and the Senate in order to be able to have the president's agenda. So focused on very critical races in both chambers nationally. And quite frankly, the president is focused on every race everywhere. So he's asking our state chairman to make sure that we do the same and be as focused as we can to win races. Whether it appears to affect the national scene or not, it does have an effect on national politics.
Well, I think this week, you know, there was much ado made about an upset. A Democrat won in Texas,
yes,
in an area that a previous Republican, I think, won by,
yes,
double digits.
Yeah, Trump won that district plus 17 in 2024. It's a good cautionary tale, which is what we are concerned about in Hawaii. That was a special election. So they're running again this year in 26. So she won and she has to run again in November. But it's a good cautionary tale because people are fatigued. And so the people didn't show out. The base didn't show out. And I could compare that to Hawaii. Low voter turnout. Less than 50% of the eligible voters vote. So less than 50% are actually electing the people to. When 45% of the people are voting, that is something that we should be concerned about. When we have the lowest voter turnout in the nation, that should concern us and ask why that is, right?
Well, you know, I know that we hear that to have a healthy democracy, you need a strong two-party system, and that hasn't always been the case here in,
yes,
Hawaii because it's been dominated by Democrats. But the party has made some gains in the Senate.
Yes.
And the House, there's still some,
yes,
infighting there at the legislature. But what do you hope to do in this second term as party chair?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is we have very focused races. You know, we can look at where our party has a good stronghold, and that's the west side, right? All up and down from Eva Beach, Kapolei, Makakilo, Waianae, that's our people, right? And as well as Mililani, North Shore with Brenton. And then we have a couple, you know, we have Jokini in Hawaii Kai and then Gardner Shimizu in Moanalua area. But that's like, when you think about it, when you think about the geography and the demographics that make up that geography, that's Hawaii. And so the people that we're trying to make sure that come out and understand what we are trying to do is to make sure that we listen to what the needs are of the people and kind of push aside all of the other distracting noises, because we do feel like the House Caucus package, for instance, is a great representation of what the people are concerned about in the areas. And again, very everyday Hawaii people live in those areas, right? From, you know, when you think about Eva Beach, Kapolei, Waianae, those are local people who are voting Republican for a reason.
Well, you know, you have a challenge because you've got maybe the more moderate Republicans, and then you have,
yes,
you know, another group that is really pushing and is really staunchly behind President Trump's,
yes,
agenda.
Yes.
And then there are other Republicans that are not comfortable with what President Trump is, mm-hmm, doing, that they think he's gone too far. So,
yes,
how do you plan to bring the party together?
Well, I think by focusing, first of all, on the things that matter most. When our caucus did their listening tour, they categorized the concerns in three things that I think most of our people can understand and appreciate: crime, public safety, cost of living, and then government corruption. Those three things should be timeless and should bridge everyone on what they believe with what the president is doing, right? So it's for us. While I am an incredible supporter of President Trump, my focus as the Hawaii chair is to increase the members, to increase the number of legislators, and then see if we can bring some balance and be the loyal opposition to what has been decades of one-party rule in Hawaii, and see if we can bring change. Because those things and the caucus package is absolutely logical. And if you were to talk to auntie and uncle, and especially on the West Side, Mililani, North Shore, these are what they're concerned about. Everyday local people are concerned about public safety, cost of living, and government corruption. And maybe if we can address that, people will want to come out and vote. Right now, they're like, well, what difference is it going to make when somebody can take $35,000 and nobody really cares about it? Like, what does it matter? You know, those kinds of things, you hear it every day. Like, what does it matter? It's going to be the same old, and we're trying to make sure that we engage the voters and tell them how important their participation is.
Well, another issue I think that the party wrestled with was what to do about the party headquarters,
yes,
on Kapi'olani Boulevard.
Yes.
And the decision was made to sell it,
yes,
because, you know, the folks that were in charge of the party then,
yes,
felt that the money should go toward helping to fund campaigns.
That's correct. So the building was a great symbol of what the donors could do. It was through a donation by a single donor that we were able to do a down payment and own that building since 1998. But the time of brick and mortar and how politics are done these days, we realized that the money could be spent differently and could be invested differently. And so it is something that they wrestled with for 10 years, and the leadership at the time decided to sell it, and we are looking to do some great things with that money and kind of seed the groundwork for what we hope will be a foundation for a great run in the future to help us build our legislative caucus.
And then what do you tell people who may be uncomfortable with what we saw happen with ICE in Minnesota, you know, where you've got U.S. citizens that are losing their lives?
Yeah.
How do you talk to people who like what they're seeing?
Yeah, I don't think anybody likes seeing anybody lose their lives, to include myself. And, you know, that violent protests that are, remember, Minnesota, I went to Minnesota right after the George Floyd thing. So that is that's ground zero for a lot of these kinds of activists. And I find it horrible that anybody loses their life. But surveys show, and even the Wall Street Journal shows, that the majority of Americans actually support bringing people who break the law and come into the country illegally to some kind of justice, not through any violent means, but that ICE is there and people are supportive of enforcement.
But we're hearing more that it's not getting rid of the worst of the worst. These are not even immigrants. You know, these are U.S. citizens. And it's just becoming increasingly distressful when the narrative is where the administration is quick to put out a narrative when the investigation is still going on. And it just makes people really uncomfortable about what's happening.
Yeah, I think, and if we look at deportations through the past four presidencies, we'll see that President Trump in this presidency, his second presidency, hasn't even reached a proportion of President Obama, President Clinton. It's the moment, right? We're in a moment, and I get it. President Trump, while he won handily, won all the swing states, won the electoral, won the popular vote, he's still pushing an uphill battle for people who don't want to see this America First agenda. And this was putting Americans first. And I get how some people don't like it. My parents are Filipino immigrants, and they are wildly supportive of it because, you know, they say we took a long time to try to be able to get in. And so people, quote unquote, cutting the line are actually hurting people who are waiting and waiting for years. And so everyday immigrants like my parents are saying, I support that. And we don't hear those voices. Those voices aren't the one in the streets, you know, with signs and pushing on. But they're not there. But they are there. And I would love to talk to immigrants, especially the Filipino community. You know, great segment of the immigrants here in Hawaii, and see what they think of us making sure that there is the right coming in the right way, as most of them did.
But some people who are waiting in line and doing things the proper way are still getting caught up in this, in these raids, you know. And I'll be honest, I mean, I'm an American citizen. Mm-hmm. I was born on a military base, but I have taken to carrying my passport card around with me at mm-hmm. all times, you know, when I travel, just in case.
Yeah, I don't feel that way. I feel that what ICE is doing is for the betterment of many Americans who don't have a voice, and the people who were disaffected, and their cities and towns are kind of getting run over by populations that they haven't seen. Places like in Colorado, we've seen over the summer, and just people from other countries kind of literally taking over buildings, to the dismay of people who actually, American citizens who actually live there. So yes, it's a two-sided coin, but I don't feel a need to carry around my passport. I am a proud American, and I know that I haven't broken any laws, and therefore I don't feel that I need to overcompensate for fear mongering that the media or some affected groups may want to share with the public.
And then, you know, you led the campaign for President Trump.
I did.
I don't know. Is there anything that he's done recently that makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable?
I have to separate the policy and the person. You know, I'm not always thrilled. I'll be honest. So you don't think I'm just a sycophant who, I don't like the way he speaks to people sometimes. I do like the tough talk in the places that it's needed, but I don't like anybody who shows people disrespect at all. So I'll give a small, for instance, like when Rob Reiner died and he was doing a tribute that really wasn't kind. I won't ever be okay with that. But I have to separate the policy, and the policies, in my opinion, have been very spot on. Again, the policy and the personality is different. I'm a military officer of several decades, and you go to war and you may not like them, but you know that we're there to win the war. The commander in chief is here to win the war, and while I may not agree with the tone and tenor of some of the messages, I 100% support him and support the policies that he's put out.
Anything else you want to add just about as you try to lead this party when you know, there's some battling within mm-hmm. In trying to keep people happy or keep them together in the same room?
Yeah, so just like any other organization, there's going to be different views. I mean, if you look at my counterparts in the Democrat Party, I don't know who's leading the National Democrat Party, really. Who is the leader? Who will they run in 2 years? I would be worried about that. But here in Hawaii, we're focused. We're focused on our home, and we're focused on the issues that matter. And so, yes, we are concerned about Minnesota, but Minnesota is so far away. When our kupuna need our help, and regular everyday people, again, our people so far are represented up and down the Waianae Coast, the West Side, Mililani, North Shore. Those are our everyday people that we are focused on. And it's hard to focus on Minnesota while we are concerned. We are 100% focused on the House caucus package that they put together. And we're focused on making sure that our keiki can come home. I know my own children cannot afford to live here, and they're on the mainland. And so, you know, they can't afford to buy their own home. It is almost, home ownership is almost out of reach. And those are the things we care about. bringing our keiki home to be able to live here. More Hawaiians live off the aina, and that should be a concern for us because they are totally priced out. And then more people just find opportunity with high cost of housing and living and low wages. There's very few opportunity for people to actually make it.
Well, Shereen Alshab, I really thank you for coming into the studio and talking with us. We were never successful in getting the last two
chairs.
I'm
so sorry.
Not, you know, for lack of trying, but it is what it is, and yes. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Shereen Alshab is the head of the Republican Party for the second time in about 5 years. She tells us during that time there were 9 elected GOP chairs. And a note, when Alshab referenced immigrant deportations, the nonprofit PolitiFact says it's difficult to compare deportation numbers under Trump's second presidency, but that overall deportations under Trump are lower than those under the Biden and Obama presidencies.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
In Mexico, the fishing village of El Bosque is being devoured by rising sea levels. That has forced its residents to move inland and adapt to a whole new lifestyle.
The landscape has changed drastically. Instead of the sea, they now look out their windows and see grassy fields where cows graze.
Hear that story and more global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Will she or won't she step down? There are some growing questions about the political future of a veteran Democrat in the Senate. Here with the story is Honolulu Civil Beat Politics Editor Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so the lawmaker we're talking about is Michelle Kadani, and she's having some health issues?
Well, that's the word from her colleagues, who are very uncomfortable to talk on the record about it. But we did speak with over a dozen people that work in that building, including people that work very closely with Senator Kadani. And the concern is that she is ill, that it has to do perhaps with her mental cognitive state, her abilities. We don't have an official information on what exactly is plaguing her. We did reach out to Senator Kadani and Ron Kochi, the Senate president, did not hear back. We do hear, though, that there may be an announcement later this week that Senator Kadani may decide to retire, perhaps at the end of this session, which would be May 8th. We're going to have to all stay tuned to see what happens, but I can just say, among other things, she's not just any senator. She's the vice president of the Senate. She's very influential in terms of education issues. And she's been there for a while, since 2008, and is very, very respected, very loved, and it's a difficult thing here in the Capitol.
Well, you know, I know she's just been this very long time dedicated public servant. I knew her when she was a staffer in Reed Moncho's office at the Honolulu City Council.
Boy, that takes me back some time. I knew she worked at the council, but I had no idea that she worked for council member Reed Moncho. I'll be darned.
Yes, you know, and it's tough, but you know, this does raise some questions of, you know, if there are health issues or memory issues that, you know, you feel for anyone, because gosh, you know, it could happen to us, right?
Oh, it can, and certainly I don't think there's anybody that's not touched in some way with their families and their friends, someone who has similar problems. But you know, this has become more under the spotlight because of Joe Biden and running for re-election and just a year and a half ago. And, of course, he ended up dropping out. We all saw the disastrous debate performance, long rumored talk about his potential physical and mental decline. And then, of course, once he dropped out, Kamala Harris ran and lost to Donald Trump. There's also talk about Donald Trump, and there's a problem there as well. And one also thinks of another prominent person, Dianne Feinstein, the California senator. She ended up dying in office a couple of years ago, and there were concerns about her cognitive ability as well. But remember, you're a public servant. You've been elected by the people. You are on their taxpayer dime for your salary, and there is an obligation to constituents as well as to the oath that you take, either the state or to the country.
Yeah, and she's been a strong advocate for education. She chaired the lower ed committee. And then I wondered when they combined lower ed and higher ed.
Yeah, this was something that kind of was a tipping point. This happened just in December. You don't change committees midstream, but what they did is the Senate combined the higher ed, lower ed into one committee, just called education. And they moved Senator Kidani to the vice chair position, elevated Donna Kim to the chair position, and she's been running that committee pretty aggressively, as is her style. But, you know, just to let you know, the House does that differently. They keep them separate. They feel like UH and the DOE and the BOE, those are big enough to deserve their own lawmakers, their own chairs, their own committees, but that is not what happened. That was the tip-off. No particularly satisfactory reason given other than we're having to deal with the Trump budget cuts, both to the higher ed and lower ed. But that was certainly a sign that there was a shifting of strategy, if you will, in determining who's best to lead the Education Committee in the Senate.
Well, I know your story says that Kidani wants to stay in office, you mentioned if she steps down before her term is up, then the governor will appoint someone else.
Yeah, it depends on the timeline. That stuff is still being determined. Will there be a special election held in conjunction with the primary, or does it fall later and then the governor gets to appoint? These are questions that, should Senator Kidani retire, that I'm sure we're going to, certainly Civil Beat and HBR will be reporting on them.
Yes, all right. Well, we will just wait to see what happens. But thank you so much, Chad.
Of course. Thanks, Catherine.
We have been hearing from political editor Chad Blair. You can read his story and more at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. It's time to dip our toes into the sand for today's quiz. You may know that much of the sand of Waikiki Beach is not from Waikiki at all. Beginning in the 1920s, replenishment efforts sailed in sand from California's Manhattan Beach and also trucked in sand from Oahu's Waimea Bay and Pohaku Beach on Molokai. We also heard one story that a stretch of once famous dunes in Australia were mined and sent to Waikiki. These giant dunes were an international draw for an otherwise industrial part of New South Wales. Families would climb up and sled down dunes the size of cliffs. The dunes would have likely been noticed by Captain James Cook, who in 1770 became the first European to see that region. And the name for this suburb comes from an Aboriginal word meaning plenty of wild fowl. For today's quiz, we want to know the name of this suburb in New South Wales that for decades blamed the loss of their precious sand dunes on Waikiki Beach. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Mm-hmm. Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NāreitHawaii.com.
What does it mean to have a free press? Well, a recent story in the Columbia Journalism Review highlighted the owner of Oahu Publications, Inc. Its flagship publication is the Honolulu Star-Advertiser, which it created in 2010 after purchasing the Honolulu Advertiser from Gannett. The Alabama company, Carpenter Media, acquired Oahu Publications and its media brands in 2024, and a recent walkout over censorship at a Carpenter-owned newsroom in Alaska prompted a closer look into this company, which is now one of the country's largest owners of local newspapers. Lois Parshley is a freelance investigative journalist who wrote the story for the Columbia Journalism Review, and she spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender.
How did this story about Carpenter Media get on your radar?
I heard about a reporter who this September covered a memorial honoring Charlie Kirk in the small coastal town of Homer, Alaska. Chloe Plesnack was 25. She'd grown up in Homer, and after working at a radio station after college, she was really thrilled to move home. The job paid less than working a fry station at McDonald's, but she considered getting it a huge stroke of luck. Unfortunately, 24 hours after this piece was published, her phone lit up with a text that she hadn't heard from in years, and he'd sent her a link to a Facebook post from Republican State Representative Sarah Vance, who denounced her article on Alaska State letterhead. Carpenter Media Group, the paper's publisher, reacted really swiftly, and without consulting Plesnack or her editor, Carpenter removed the article from the website, altered it according to the representative's objections, and republished the piece without a note to indicate it had been changed. Today, actually, the Legislative Ethics House Subcommittee in Alaska announced an investigation of complaints filed against Representative Vance.
Wow. So all of this went on and you took note of it. And then why look into Carpenter, the group?
Yeah, so the resulting investigation published at Columbia Journalism Review examines Carpenter Media's really rapid growth. They went from 27 publications in 2024 to over 250 today. They've become America's fourth largest newspaper company very quickly. In Hawaii, they took over Oahu Publications, which is the parent company of seven papers that they now own, including the Honolulu Star Advertiser, the Hawaii Tribune Herald, and West Hawaii Today. West Hawaii Today in particular is a great example. It no longer has any reporters and is essentially a ghost paper. That's a pattern for Carpenter. Its acquisitions have come with widespread layoffs, staff treatment that's led to repeated resignations, and editorial interventions like the one that Plesnack saw.
Yeah, I mean, the subhead of your story is notable. It reads, "In just a few years, a publisher based in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, has become the country's fourth largest newspaper operator. Some reporters wonder if it isn't the cruelest." So you mentioned that example in Alaska, but what are the other sorts of things that Carpenter has done with the publications it has acquired in recent years?
Carpenter Media's representatives told me that it sees itself as saving local journalism. That can be partially true. Some papers, you may have heard, journalism is facing a budget crisis, and some of those papers might cease to exist without new ownership. But what I found in this reporting is that Carpenter's ownership often comes with trade-offs. Its newsrooms are frequently understaffed, people are often laid off after it acquires a paper, and the remaining reporters are held to really high story quotas. In places like Hawaii, we're having local journalists who understand the geography and the culture and local nuances. Those kinds of trade-offs really matter.
What kinds of reports did you find come out of the Honolulu Star Advertiser? How do the staffers who are unionized portray this situation?
A publication's ownership shapes what gets covered, what doesn't, how aggressively a newsroom can hold power to account. Like, that's just a general principle that I think is really important for readers to understand. Kevin Nodell, a union steward and a reporter for the Honolulu Star-Advertiser, told me that when regional reporting staff get laid off and local outlets aren't able to cover as many stories that impact their communities, it's a lot harder to report on what local lawmakers are doing, and both local readers and national ones can miss what the federal government is doing. In Hawaii, he said, the evisceration of regional media has really damaged our news environment because there's no shortage of important news. So he's someone who really wants to be able to keep serving this community, but he told me, quote, it's getting harder every day to do it with organizations that with corporate owners that don't seem to value these communities in the same way that we do. And from my reporting, I found that that loss is cumulative. So fewer local reporters like Kevin means fewer national stories that are grounded in people's real lived experience and generally a public discourse that's increasingly detached from the full geography of American power and responsibility. It also leaves journalists who once filled those pages with nowhere to go.
I think there's a lot in your story that concerned me as a journalist and might concern readers and listeners. But one thing that stood out was the lack of editorial independence to see the situation that you write about in Alaska and think about if something like that in Hawaii could happen. I mean, did you find there to be any checks and balances, oversight, ways that local papers can stop higher-ups at Carpenter from meddling in what ends up getting published or staying on a website?
So one thing that Homer residents did this winter, because they were concerned about Carpenter's role in their community, is they pooled resources together and started an independent nonprofit paper called Homer Independent Press. Right now, it has an all-volunteer editorial board, but they hope to expand. In Juneau, where the staff and editor of another paper Carpenter acquired also resigned, they went on to launch another nonprofit newsroom called the Juneau Independent last June. These are, I think, are great examples of people coming together to support a truly free press. But I will say it's an uphill battle. Finding sustainable business models for journalism is certainly a challenge.
Why should listeners or readers care who owns the media brand that they consume?
It matters if they want to have information about their communities that is accurate and that can help answer questions from who should I vote for on my ballot to why is there traffic in this particular area to understanding if local water quality sources are being monitored in the ways that they should be. These are all things that impact people's daily lives, and that's the sort of basic civic mortar that local journalism provides. And communities should feel empowered to ask basic questions about who owns their news and how many reporters there are, and if that feels sufficient to the kinds of news that they are or aren't getting. Local journalism works best when it's accountable, not just to its owners, but to the people it serves.
One question I was left with at the end of reading your article is, who is giving Carpenter all the money? And it doesn't seem to be a straightforward answer.
Yes, I'm so glad that you brought that up. I share questions around Carpenter Media's financial information. As a private company, they are not obligated to share that information publicly, which makes their funding and business decisions difficult to track. The Pacific Northwest Newspaper Guild, part of the National Journalist Union, shares these questions. Their executive officer told me that she's very concerned about the lack of transparency in Carpenter's financial models and about their corresponding freedom of the press. It's hard to know if there might be conflicts of interest or what might be guiding some of their editorial decisions without being able to know that. But again, they are not required to disclose that information.
That was journalist Lois Parshley, who talked recently with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to Parshley's article in the Columbia Journalism Review on our website after the show. We'll be right back.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Aloha, Leimomi here, host of After Hours on Tuesday evenings. Join me at 10 p.m. for Uanoa, playing sounds of the Pacific from across Moana Nui Akea. From Maori alt to Samoan shoegaze, Hawaii hip-hop to archival gems, artists and musicians that speak our oceanic realities. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours. Tuesday from 10 p.m. to midnight on HBR1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
It's time to wash off the sand and reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier, we gave you a rundown of the history of Waikiki sand, and erosion has prompted local officials to replenish the sand at various points in the history of the beach, trucking it in from elsewhere on Oahu and Molokai, and sailing sand in from Manhattan Beach, California. One of the unexpected consequences of removing mountains of sand from beaches on Oahu's North Shore is said to be the creation of the Waimea Bay Jump Rock. But we also told you about a myth from a suburb in Australia that long blamed Waikiki for the loss of its famous dunes. As it turns out, the sand from these sprawling dunes was not sent to Waikiki Beach, although Australian sand has been used to fill golf course sand traps in Hawaii. What's more likely is that sand simply eroded over time, much like Waikiki Beach itself. We asked for the name of this New South Wales suburb that means plenty of wildfowl in an Australian Aboriginal language, and we were looking for Port Kembla. And congrats to Ellen from Wailuku. She knew the answer. She says her sister lives in Australia. And if you enjoyed this history lesson, check out our Live from Waikiki Coastal Erosion Show from May of 2025. You can search for it on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. A bodyboard and a garden hose. This invention on Oahu's North Shore sparked a revolution in surfer safety about a half a century ago. With the World Surf League's Alexis Pipe Challenger competition in full swing, we wanted to dive into the history of a modern ocean rescue system that's become a feature of competitive surfing and lifeguarding around the world. Mark Dombrowski began lifeguarding on Oahu's North Shore in 1975. He retired in 2016. The Aikau brothers, Eddie and Clyde, recruited Dombrowski and mentored him for the first few years of his career as they and others worked to develop a rescue system using jet skis. HPR's G.W. Gibson recently visited Dombrowski at Waimea Bay, where the retired lifeguard still works out several times a week. Dombrowski reflected on his role in the development of modern-day lifeguarding.
The main thing was the sled in order to pick somebody up. And that started out with a bodyboard, you know, a regular boogie board, and attaching some handles and some hoses, garden hoses to it, and just rigging it up on the back of the ski. Nobody had done that before. These were the first guys.
A bodyboard and garden hose rigged up to the back of a jet ski.
Yeah. It went from a bodyboard, like a regular Mori board, then it turned into the soft top. They cut off the nose of it and reattached that because it was longer and you could fit two people on it. And this was, the bodyboards hadn't been around that long.
Yeah, head up in front of the tower, you're going to be way back in before this next set comes. You're going to get flushed.
That works, right? Nobody else was doing it. The Hawaiians were the only ones that put that all together back then. You know, I hate to be a name dropper, but I got to give credit to the guys that started it out here as far as the ski goes and the rescue techniques. And that was Brian Kealana, Mel Pu'u, Dennis Govea, and Terry Ahui. Without those guys seeing what the ski could do as far as lifeguarding goes, I don't know where it would have gone, you know, or how much longer it would have taken. Because this was the late 80s, early 90s when it all began and all the research and development among those guys. So, yeah, there's the evolution of it because there were a bunch of guys. Raging Isle made a bodyboard. Wahoo Bodyboards made a bodyboard. Dean Marzal, who's a lifeguard on the west side. There's all these different evolutions of the board over the years. Because some of them worked and some of them didn't. I think the biggest thing was the rigging and the safety aspect of it. You know, being able to put the handles in the right places, being able to get patients on the board and securing them to the board with your own body, like pressing them to the board and getting out through surf and riding, you know, through surf and stuff like that. And picking up unconscious patients. All these techniques were developed by the Hawaii lifeguards. And this, all the techniques that are used today, you know, wearing your kill switch on your right wrist instead of your left wrist, because this is where the throttle was. So you grab the person with your left wrist when you're picking them up and send them back to the grabber, having that second person on the back, which is the grabber doesn't get as much credit as the driver, of course. But you got to trust your driver. You got to put your trust in everything he does because you have no control over that. So now you got to trust him. You got to trust him to bring you to that patient. You got to trust him to grab him and pass him back to you, and you secure him on the back of the sled. It doesn't sound or look that complicated when guys are doing it, the right guys. But in reality, there's a lot of things, the movement of the water, the size of the wave. Sometimes you can't pick them up the first time you drive in. You have to go around and go get them again. So there's all kind of little speed bumps that come up along the way in, you know, getting your patients to shore and stuff like that.
Anytime you see, you know, Michael Jordan going for a layup or Shohei Ohtani pitch or whatever, it looks easy, right? So guys develop the skill to do this well and make it look very easy, but that is a sort of hidden skill.
Yeah, it is, and it takes years to get really good at it. You know what I mean? Like, there'll be mistakes made along the way in anything else. Just like Michael Jordan will miss a layup maybe once in a while or something, or Shohei Ohtani will hit somebody with a ball. But it's a different situation because this is life threatening kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Not necessarily always, you know, sometimes it's just a routine rescue that someone needs assistance to get to shore. But in those other situations, it can be really critical of your timing, of when you're going in to get that patient. There's always an entrance into a certain situation, a way to get in, but is there always an exit? You know, are you able to get out of where you just put yourself? I would say everybody is capable of doing that. It's just timing of Mother Nature that can really change the dynamics of what's gonna happen. And like you said, it'll look easy, but it's just like anything else. Kids in the shore break will make the shore break look easy. But Joe Schmo is gonna struggle out there. I don't care how good a swimmer you are. If you haven't experienced, you know, shore break and certain conditions, you're going to struggle.
So there's the element of the tow-in system itself and getting that refined, but then there's also the element of technique, right? So both of those things were kind of being learned in the late 80s, early 90s, the equipment itself, but also technique, both of those.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I want to say almost every contest now has a ski in the water with a sled on it. If I'm watching surfing on TV, it's in Australia or whatever, everybody's doing pretty much the same thing. The ski was one of the biggest things, I think, in modernizing lifeguarding around the world, not just in Hawaii. Hawaii was the first place, and now it's used all over the world, and that just proves what an awesome tool it is. And in fact, back in the early 90s, the first manual was written by the guys out here. You know, we all participated in helping write that manual, taking photos of all the techniques, all the grabbing and stuff like that, all the techniques of putting people on the sled and how to do it. And that became a big part of the progression of the ski and safety and the sled and the drivers and the grabbers. And without a lot of that, guys would be just winging it, you know what I mean, like on certain things. But now there's a certain protocol to follow of how to do things. And I think for the most part, anybody that's doing safety for a contest or swim race or anything are pretty much on the same page now. And this is almost, 30 years later. It's pretty refined now. I think it's in a really good, solid place as far as safety goes.
What did you do in the 70s and early 80s before all of this was developed?
Yeah, it was like good old manual labor. It's run down the beach, no jet ski to help you out when you're out in the middle of the ocean with your patient. It's swim back to shore or call the helicopter, the HFD helicopter with a basket on it, or a surfboard. There were no radios. There was no backup as far as like mobile patrollers, they call them now, mobile patrol. The fire would back you up, but it was you and your partners. That was it, you know what I mean? And the trust that you had in your partners was the biggest thing back then. There was no cavalry coming. It was just another guy in your tower. That's how it ended up. It's not, there's not two skis coming to help you. There's not an ATV to take you down to where you got to get in the water. You ran down there, you know, you with your fins and tube, and you swam out. And there wasn't a lot of options. I used to come down here like a lot of kids do in the summertime, jump off the rock, you know, 15 years old, freshman in high school, body surf the shore break with some of my friends, and then ended up meeting Eddie and Clyde because they were the lifeguards here at that time. And you just become like a beach rat. And as time went on, we became friends. And then Eddie told me that they were having tryouts for lifeguards. I didn't have a path set yet in my life. So I went to the Y, got my senior life saving, then got my first aid from Lelehua High School. I graduated from Lelehua. Ended up training at the natatorium. That's where we did our training, and that's where our headquarters was at that at the natatorium. And then along the way, I met a lot of good people, worked with a lot of awesome people too. I worked with Eddie for like 3 years because the Hokulea took off in 78 and I started in 75. So that's where I was able to learn quite a bit in a short period of time. And actually coming to work was at that time like almost a privilege to be able to come here and work.
And you talk about the importance of trust in those early days. I'm sure that element of trust has never gone away. I'm sure it remains. But I wonder how, when you were coming up, you were young, you were just getting started, and the guys who were teaching you, Clyde and Eddie, how did they communicate trust? How was trust built?
I think it almost becomes like a personal friendship almost, you know what I mean? I worked with some guys that were big time guys, you know what I mean? At my age, I didn't realize it as much until later, you know what I mean? When you're actually working with someone that is somebody, you know, in the surfing world and stuff like that. And I think personally for me, it was more like the bonding thing. And I felt like they were my big brothers. They trusted me because they were my teachers too, right? You know what I mean? If I didn't learn right, I could be an anchor to them. You know what I mean? If they can't trust me to go help them and I can't trust them to help me. And it was never like an ego thing. It was more like just a friendship and being taught by people that cared about their job and cared about the people they worked with and cared about the public. And it all comes together as far as trust goes. I bonded with these guys and I was able to pick things up quicker because they were willing to help me learn these things. You got to be on the same page when you come into these situations because nobody's going to be telling you what to do in a lot of situations. One guy takes off to go on a rescue. The other guy has to know what to do next, go grab the board. Sometimes you don't even communicate. And you just feed off of each other and you know what your job is and they know what their job is and you just pull it off and hopefully everybody gets back to shore. That's the thing.
Yeah, all those unspoken communications. Well, and it sounds like by and large, the guys who were teaching you were patient.
Yeah, I got to agree with that because, I mean, to me, when they got in, there were less teachers. The North Shore didn't get a lifeguard until like the late 60s, I believe, you know, when Eddie got in. So I don't know who was teaching him. His skill level was above everything else, but as far as rescuing and stuff like that, there weren't a lot of teachers back then. They had all the skills in the world as far as watermen go, but I think maybe they felt a need to train people more so than how they got trained. You know what I mean? It was the beginning of the North Shore out here back then, as far as lifeguards go. You know, there weren't towers out here where they are now. I feel like those guys were a big foundation out here as far as lifeguarding goes. And they had a lot of respect already from a lot of their peers. So being able to learn from those guys, I got lucky, basically, to be able to come out here and learn from the best. It was like a privilege for me. And I didn't know that, you know, as a kid.
When did that hit you?
The Eddie and the Hokulea thing really, I was like 26 maybe or something like that. That was basically when my career started. So I was looking, going, I'm gonna work with Eddie for a while. You know what I mean? We'd go to the fire station, play volleyball after work with the firemen, and we did other things outside of lifeguarding. And I feel like that really made me think a little bit more about who I'm around and who I'm with and how much respect I have for certain people. And it comes down to how you're treated and how you treat people. I felt like these guys a little bit older than me, treated me really good and fair. And it didn't always have to do with work. You know what I mean? Work is work and time off is time off. And I feel like they were friends almost more so than they were coworkers. You know what I mean? When you get that feeling when you bond with somebody and you go, we're on the same page for a lot of things. You know what I mean? And even though they were older, when you're young, you think they're way older, but they're not way older. They're like 5-6 years older than you, but maybe the things they've done and the life they've been on, they seem like they're 10-15 years older. Back then, I never knew how old anybody was. I never asked anybody, how old are you? Never. They were just my coworkers and my friends, and I could care less how old they were. But that's where their knowledge was that much farther ahead of me. It really, I think, made a difference in how I thought about life, even with my own family. You know, try and pace myself and do the right things. And, you know, even this job, I never thought I'd work this job as long as I did. But the time just flew by and here I am now. It's just one of those things that life takes you on crazy journeys sometimes.
That was Mark Dombrowski talking to HPR's G.W. Gibson about the development of modern-day ocean rescue systems and the influence that lifeguards from Hawaii have had on the profession around the world. And that does it for us today. Tomorrow we go back to the time of the kingdom and consider its policies about vaccines and infectious disease. We welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.